York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
Welcome to your favorite listener-supported commercial-free radio station, WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. You're listening to Black Star News Show, and I'm your host, Milton Alimadi. Today's guests are Ted Glick, the author of Burglar for Peace, Lessons Learned in the Catholic Left's Resistance to the Vietnam War. We'll discuss his book, and he'll explain what the term burglar for peace means. And he'll also let us know, whatever happened to the Catholic left? Where are they today? The second guest in the bottom half hour of the show is Brother Shahid Muhammad. He's an organizer and activist with the December 12th movement, and he's involved in the planning of the National Reparations Day, the protest rally, which will be national events, as well as one right here in New York City at Trump International Hotel at Columbus Circle. So before we get into that, though, I need to remind you, listeners, we only survive to the extent that you support us. And we hope you see value in our station and our numerous fabulous shows. So I remind you, please pick up the phone, dial 516-620-3602. Any donation, any contribution will be put to very good use. And today's guest, Ted Glick, has also offered copies of his book, Burglar for Peace. And we will be able to provide a copy of that book to anybody who decides to become a WBAI buddy today in the name of Black Star News Show. And you can do that by going to give and then the number 2, WBAI.org. And by doing so, the money is taken out of your credit card or your debit card on a monthly basis. So now, let me welcome our first guest to today's show. Ted Glick, welcome to Black Star News Show.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Glad to be on.
The title of your book, Burglar for Peace, Lessons Learned in the Catholic Left's Resistance to the Vietnam War. Before I get into the book, tell listeners who Ted Glick is. Who is Ted Glick? Briefly, so we know who's writing this book.
Okay, I became an activist on April 4th, 1968, when Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, literally. I had been developing my understandings of the world, my consciousness before that point. Definitely was very impacted by the civil rights movement, the Black Freedom Movement, by what was happening in Vietnam and Indochina. And as a result of being moved to action, I just continued to be an activist, developed into an organizer. I ended up leaving college, ended up being active with this wing of the anti-Vietnam War peace movement led by priests and nuns, Catholic priests and nuns, that was going into draft boards and destroying draft files, going into FBI offices and removing them, removing incriminating files or trying to, going into war corporation offices. It was all nonviolent, but it was also very disruptive and kind of an escalation of tactics, you could say. That led to me being in prison for a year, but it also led to me during that time in prison becoming very clear that the system was really fundamentally flawed on so many levels. I just learned a great deal there. And so ever since prison, I have been an organizer, an activist, a writer, trying to transform our society, transform the world. For the last 17 or 18 years, my primary focus, and it continues to be that, my primary focus is the climate crisis.
Right.
Deepening climate crisis, but I continue to also be connected with other movements.
Yes, and I have to say we've been privileged to publish many of your columns on the environment, environmental racism as well.
Right.
Okay, so in your introduction, you've already answered parts of my question, because a listener would want to know the title, Burglar for Peace. I think you addressed a little bit of that, but I'd like you to say a little more about it.
Right.
But then before you get into that, the second part of the title of the book provokes the question, because it says, lessons learned in the Catholic left's resistance to the Vietnam War.
Right.
So a listener might ask themselves, Catholic left, where is the Catholic left? Where are they today? When you see a Cardinal Dolan, for example, writing an op-ed in the New York Post, basically defending the police and not addressing the systemic historical racism that led to the recent series of murders, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and of course, George Floyd. It's very intriguing for people to know that there once was actually a vigorous Catholic left.
Mm-hmm.
You can answer both parts of the question.
Yeah, I will talk about that. I definitely would like to talk about the Catholic left then and now. First, in terms of the burglar for peace question, that's literally what we did. I learned how to figure out how to get into office buildings where there were draft boards, and to get then into those draft boards, and to, in the middle of the night, put draft boards into big duffel bags and get them out safely and take them somewhere where they were burned. Or in some cases, once I spent 5 hours with all of this was with other people, of course, inside a draft board, cutting up and destroying draft files because there wasn't any other way we could do it. So I had to learn the skills, the techniques of burgling buildings. So if anybody ever needs some help with that, I'm your man. But I haven't used those techniques for decades, so they're probably a little rusty. But
in fact, you stole part of another question that I had down. I was going to say, why don't you offer techniques for the contemporary struggle, you know? But go ahead. I want you to continue responding to your question.
Okay. So in terms of the Catholic left question, my first thought in terms of when you spoke about Dolan was then there was Pope Francis, right? There's Pope Francis, who is very progressive. He's very strong on issues of poverty, economic injustice, and also very much the climate. And those are major issues for him. I mean, the Catholic Church is, you know, it's such a huge institution. It's got an awful lot of bad things that have happened in the Catholic Church historically, going back centuries for sure. Its alliance with essentially imperialism, European imperialism, all the scandal of the Catholic priests, you know, with young people, all of that. But there has definitely been look at liberation theology. Look at liberation theology in South America beyond South America to other parts of the globe. Definitely that came out of the Catholic, you know, reality, the Catholic Church.
True.
So, you know, I was privileged. I was lucky enough to make connection with these priests, these nuns, these Catholic lay people, as well as lots of others who weren't Catholic and weren't even religious. And at that point, I really wasn't very religious. And they were about something very different. I mean, they essentially were pretty revolutionary in what they wanted to do. And I related to that. There definitely are very progressive Catholics today. There's different organizations that exist. Pax Christi, for example, is one of them, very active around peace issues. There's a group, Franciscans for Justice, I believe it's called, Franciscan Brothers, and others in that wing of the Catholic Church. So there definitely are Catholics around, and organized forms for those progressive Catholics to take action and to stand up for the right things.
All right. And in your book, you say one of the books, I think you were in college at that time, that inspired you was the autobiography of Malcolm X.
Right.
And before you comment on that, I also want to read a quote from the book. This is actually what Muhammad Ali said in reference to why he had refused to sign on to the draft. And I want to read this because not enough people know how progressive Ali really was, way ahead of his time. Yeah, and this is what he said. Why should they ask me to put on a uniform and go 10,000 miles from home and drop bombs and bullets on brown people in Vietnam while so-called Negro people in Louisville are treated like dogs, denied human rights? No, I'm not going 10,000 miles from home to help murder and burn another poor nation simply to continue the domination of white slave masters of the darker people the world over. This is the day when such evils must come to an end. And this is Muhammad Ali.
Yeah, right.
Speak a little bit about that.
Well, the autobiography of Malcolm X, just to bring that in too, definitely was very formative for me. Where, in terms of where I grew up, I did not grow up in areas where there were very many black people or brown people. Very few, frankly. Very, very few. All through high school. Wasn't until I went to college that I began to interact more and meet, you know, develop some friendships with people of color. But the autobiography of Malcolm X was very helpful for me to understand kind of the reality for black people in the United States and through his life and all his experiences, as well as his wisdom. And kind of similarly, you know, with Muhammad Ali, I really, in presenting, which I do in the first chapter, kind of the picture of the general draft resistance movement, which began to emerge in 1965
right.
in the United States. Actually, one of the other things that's in my book is I have a short little quote from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC,
right.
Calling upon young black men not to go to Vietnam and to resist the draft. That was a very early stage of the draft resistance movement, and here they were, kind of basically giving leadership in terms of a way to respond to it. A lot of times people look upon the peace movement with good reason as essentially more of a white, kind of predominantly white movement. But the reality is that that's not true. And as this example I just kind of used shows, and as Muhammad Ali's quote and his willingness to do what he did, I mean, he risked a great deal by taking the position that he did. It shows that black people of color were very much out there in front in terms of articulating and standing up for what needed to be done about the war.
Right, and he sacrificed quite a lot. All right, so now, obviously, what you were doing would not be considered legal by the government, right?
That's
right. At some point, you paid the price for it as well.
Right.
So tell listeners about what became the Rochester case.
Right.
And also talk after that about the Harrisburg case.
Yeah, there were two political trials during that period of time that I was part of. The first one was in Rochester, New York. I and seven other people went into a very old federal building over Labor Day weekend in 1970. We went into the offices of Selective Service and the FBI and the U.S. Attorney. And we did a lot of damage within the Selective Service office. Within the FBI office, there were a number of files that people found, incriminating files. Probably would have been the first blowing the whistle, for example, in COINTELPRO. You know, the FBI under J.
Right.
Hoover's whole program of going after, you know, black people, people of color, the American Indian movement, et cetera.
Right.
But we didn't get out. We were arrested literally just as we were about to leave the building. So we went to trial, had a great trial,
Before you get into the trial,
sure.
Did somebody tip off the FBI?
Yeah, no, it turns out there was a government informant within
right.
this Catholic Left network.
That's
a whole long story. There definitely wasn't
as always.
And okay.
Get to the trial.
Okay. So the trial was, there were two major reasons why we ended up having a very political, three, I guess. One is that we defended ourselves. Seven of the eight of us defended ourselves. We had one person who had a lawyer kind of as an advisor. And that opened up the courtroom. That definitely was our experience. It's been true elsewhere that defendants defending themselves. You know, you're not trained lawyers, and tends to open things up. It can do that. Second reason, very important, was that after we were arrested, there was just a tremendous amount of very good community organizing in the town of Rochester, led by particularly a woman named Carolyn Micklem, working with others. We spoke before all kinds of groups. We were on television, you know, leafleting, literature, all these things you do. So that by the time of the trial, about 2.5 months after we were arrested, the town had essentially turned around. There was much more support, much more openness to people hearing why we had done what we had done. And then the third reason, and very much influenced by those first two, was that we had a judge who had been appointed, as a matter of fact, by Franklin Delano Roosevelt back in the 1930s. He was an older guy, an old-time liberal. And he ended up being relatively pretty liberal in the courtroom. Again, I think a lot of because of these other two factors. So we were convicted, but we actually had a hung jury, 9-3 for conviction. It ended up becoming, it was unlocked. They recommended leniency on all the six felonies for each of us. So all of that ended up with us getting a year to a year and a half when we were fully expecting 5 to 10 years, because it wasn't just the Selective Service. It was the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office kind of protesting the whole criminal justice system. So then while I was in prison, I was indicted as one of the members of the Harrisburg Eight. It was a supposed conspiracy made up by J. Edgar Hoover to kidnap Henry Kissinger, who was then Nixon's national security advisor, and blow up heating tunnels under Washington, D.C. Neither of those things were being planned. Nothing was happening along those lines, but they made up this conspiracy. And they lost that trial big. It was a hung jury there in Harrisburg, but it was 10-2 for acquittal on the conspiracy charge. That was a big defeat for the government. So
you think the Rochester outcome helped with the Harrisburg trial?
I think it helped. Yeah, there was a number of things that kind of kept developing, and certainly the fact that we had such a really powerful trial politically and in other ways, I think definitely had some impact. Yep.
All right, listeners, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Black Star News Show on WBI 99.5 FM radio. I'm your host, Milton Alimadi. Our guest today is author Ted Glick. He is a lifetime activist, I would say, and we're discussing his book, Burglar for Peace, fascinating book. And he has generously offered 6 copies of this book for people that decide to support Black Star News Show today. So please do go to givetowbai.org and become a WBAI buddy under the name of Black Star News Show. That means the money is taken out of your account on a monthly basis from your credit or your debit card. We appreciate the gift from our author, Ted Glick. Yes, why don't we continue with the discussion? Harrisburg, what were some of the outcomes after that, after the acquittal, ultimately?
The interesting thing about that acquittal, essentially, the government dropped the charges. It wasn't exactly an acquittal. It was a hung jury. Right. Because it was so overwhelmingly for acquittal, the government dropped the charges. There weren't really any other, I don't think there were any other trials, any other major trials or even small trials, as I remember, on these, for this particular movement, this wing of the movement. What instead happened was that as that trial ended in the spring of 1972, there was a whole escalation that was happening in Southeast Asia with a much more intense air war being waged, the mining of the harbors in Hanoi and Haiphong. There was talk of bombing dikes. There was talk of using nuclear weapons. It was really a scary time. And a group of us, convened by Father Dan Berrigan about a month after that trial ended, decided to do a open-ended fast, an open-ended water-only fast. It ended up going 40 days. There were 7 of us who went a full 40 days on water-only. We all along were considering whether we should just continue it indefinitely with, you know, who knows the results. That was how serious we thought things were. So, but we eventually decided to end it after 40 days. Fortunately, I would definitely not ascribe this to the fast. There were other factors at work for sure. But fortunately, about 6 months later, the Paris Peace Agreement was signed in January of 1973. I honestly think the primary reason was because when there was this huge, this B-52 reign of terror on North Vietnam over Christmas, it was the Christmas bombings that the Nixon administration unleashed. It turned out that was the last gasp of the Nixon administration. And when a lot of those B-52s were shot down they didn't do the destruction and didn't break the back of the Vietnamese the way they had hoped, essentially the U.S. then was willing to finally negotiate in, I wouldn't say good faith, but negotiate seriously. And there was an agreement that eventually led to the liberation of Vietnam from colonialism after decade after decade after decade of imperialist domination from mainly France. And then the U.S.
Right. And a heroic resistance by the Vietnamese. Yeah.
Yep.
Now, in your book, you have a section called Unlearning White Supremacy. I just want to read a little bit from that section because we're going to run out of time. And then I want you to comment about why you felt it was critical to have that section in this book. Without any doubt, it was my 11 months in prison that got me firmly onto the road to consciously attempting on a daily basis to be anti-racist and a strong ally of people of color because of the many black and brown people I met, befriended, and interacted with every day. I already believed intellectually that all people should be treated equally and fairly in prison. In prison, I came to see that, this is a new sentence, in prison, I came to see that all people are, in essence, the same, with similar feelings, ideas, hopes, and dreams. And then I'm going to cut some sections and go further down and continue. It was meant joining organizations that are predominantly African-American and following and sometimes taking part in those groups' leadership. And it has meant continuing to wrestle with whether I am doing enough, whether I should be doing something more or something else, whether I really am being a good anti-racist ally. And then let me read finally from another section from that same segment. To sharpen the point, white progressives need to be willing to intelligently risk being uncomfortable, unpopular, or even victims of psychological or physical abuse for speaking up among a predominantly white group of regular folks. I don't mean so much a predominantly white group of progressives, though there are often subtler, less overt issues there too. I'm talking about average working class or middle class white people. Go ahead, the floor is yours. I want you to elaborate about that and on the importance of that, because this is often the unsaid thing. Mm-hmm. Very rarely is it discussed, the disconnect between progressives and the sometimes specific issues that African Americans and African descendants need to confront in this country.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I see that my responsibility is one to support the particular struggles, as you're saying, the particular struggles of African American people of color, as generally are defined by those movements. It's not that every individual person sees it exactly the same way, but that the general support is there for progressive initiatives and progressive actions. So that's number one. That's very important. But I also think it's very critical, as I say, that I consciously work in at either at a workplace or in a community where there are it's predominantly white people, and that I essentially look for opportunities to raise these issues of racial justice and racism. You know, when somebody, for example, tells a racist joke, that I indicate, you know, that I really don't think that's very funny. You know, as an organizer, you can't just kind of always come out and be real strong about what you feel. Maybe you can if you've gotten to know the people and they've come to understand who you are and trust you more or less and see that you're not some kind of, quote, guilty white liberal just trying to, you know, rag them. But that you're a genuine person. So, you know, you have it's not like you have to do it in a way that's smart, okay, so that it has some impact. But you need to be willing to do that. And it's not always easy. It's definitely not always easy. I know that from experience. I've never been physically attacked when I've kind of said something or raised something. But there definitely have been times when I was kind of on the alert because I thought maybe something like that might happen. So, you know, and it really is true that people, white people in this racist white society, you know, white supremacist society, we really need to, you know, constantly be thinking about, meditating on, but also talking with other people, particularly, you know, friends of color, about whether we are being consistent in our daily life with our views and our actions. It's like an unlearning process that frankly never ends. Because again, the reality of racism is so deep.
And it starts with honesty. There has to be a level of honesty to get into that kind of activism. So we've essentially run out of time. I want you to tell listeners any final observations from you are writing this book, if you want to relate it to the contemporary struggles or anything you want to say. What are your closing words?
Well, I do want to tell people they can get the book by going to PM Press, like the opposite of AM, pmpress.org. And then up at the top, just put in my name in the search box and everything will come up.
While you're at that, also tell people how they can get in touch with you in case somebody wanted to get involved in a conversation with you.
You go to my website, my personal website, which is just myname.com, tedglick.com. You can contact me through that. The fact that this book ended up coming out, like literally right in the middle of this whole Black Lives Matter upsurge, it's a fortunate thing for me, frankly. And I'm really glad, actually, that this book is out there at this time, because I do think, you know, I think some of what we just talked about, I mean, it's definitely relevant. It's definitely connected to what's now happening. So I hope that people will check it out. I've gotten a lot of good response, good input from people. You never know about these things. You think you've put something together that's good. But it's really other people and how they respond to it that's the real story of it, and I feel very hopeful about this book getting around and hope people want to check it out.
Okay, and everything you did, is there anything you would have done differently when you engaged in the struggle back in the day?
No, there's nothing in particular. Well, actually, yes, there is one thing. One part of the book is about my estrangement from Father Phil Berrigan, who was the leader. He was the originator of this movement.
Right. There was a falling out
and
at some point.
There was a falling out, and we didn't talk for 18 years. And that definitely I regret. I really regret. There was an important learning experience that I went through about my own arrogance as a young person, frankly. And my letting a difference on tactics, because that's what it was. We just differed on what we thought were the right tactics to let that, you know, keep us separated after we'd been through so much together. So that, I regret that. I definitely.
But you reconciled.
But we reconciled. That's the
important thing. That's a good way to end the book as well. Brothers, if you're just tuning in, welcome to Black Star News Show. on your favorite listener-supported commercial-free radio station, WBAI New York 99.5 FM Radio. I'm your host, Milton Alimadi. In the first half hour, our guest was Ted Glick, and we discussed his book, Burglar for Peace, Lessons Learned in the Catholic Left's Resistance to the Vietnam War. And he's made copies of his book available to people that are willing to become buddies today. So I invite you to go to WBAI, go to give, and then the number 2, WBAI.org. So that is give, the number 2, WBAI.org, and you can become a buddy in the name of Black Star News Show. And any contribution is welcome to become a buddy. The money is taken on a monthly basis from your debit card or your credit card. And others who just want to make a contribution to the show or to the station today, you can also do that by dialing the number 516-620-3602. I now go to our second guest, Brother Shahid Muhammad, who's going to discuss the National Reparations Day, which is upcoming. Welcome to Black Star News Show, Brother Shahid.
Pleased to be here, Milton. Pleased to be here in this COVID-19.
Right. So let's get straight to it. Tell us a little bit about December 12th movement. So listeners, your works of resistance that D12 has been involved in or has actually spearheaded in the past. I know one of the most recent ones was the Defund NYPD campaign. And I know D12 has also been at the forefront of trying to get the racist, illegal criminal sanctions against Zimbabwe lifted, the sanctions by the United States. So tell us a little bit about D12 in case there's some listeners out there that are not familiar.
Okay, well, as you've laid out a local, a national, and an international perspective to the work of the December 12th movement. That's who we are. We are a Pan-Africanist revolutionary organization, and our work is primarily concerned with the liberation of Africans here in the U.S., but then in general, we are concerned with Africans all over the diaspora. So Zimbabwe is an expression of that, being the target of the fascistic attacks of the United States and other European allies of the U.S. We support the people of Zimbabwe in a fight to maintain their sovereignty. And we fight to support our people's right to walk the streets of New York City free from police harassment, terror, brutality, and murder.
All right. And December 12th does not only speak or intellectualize about these issues, you actually set foot on the ground. So, for example, when you talk about Zimbabwe, you've actually, as a individuals, collectively as a group, you've traveled there several times.
Absolutely. We have traveled there. We have been received and welcomed there by the people, by the government and the Revolutionary Party, the freedom fighters, and we have adopted Zimbabwe as home, and Zimbabwe has adopted us, the December 12th movement, as comrades and fellow Zimbabweans. So we have been always clear we are Africans, but we are Africans and our home is Zimbabwe.
And so December 12th is actually continuing and expanding on the legacy of Brother Malcolm X, who saw the critical importance of combining the African diaspora or Africans in America with the struggle on the continent. And that's why he went and he met several African leaders. He met several African intellectuals, students, and even attended the Organization of African Unity meeting in Cairo in 1964. And I guess D12 is continuing that legacy.
Absolutely. Is that correct? Absolutely. We are continuing that legacy and the expression of the National Reparations Day rally, August 15th, to be held in front of the Trump International Hotel, is the expression of that. At 2 p.m. Saturday, all roads lead to 59th Street and Columbus Circle in Manhattan for the National Day of Reparations, where we come to raise our voices in unity as Black people, as progressive thinking people who support Black people's right for reparations. And this Reparations Day is but a continuation of the tying of the national and the international work of Malcolm X. Because you see, Milton, we went to Durban in 2001 right. to fight for the declaration that UN declaration that declared that slavery and the transatlantic slave trade were crimes against humanity, of which the United States and many European countries, France, England, Germany, and the list goes on and on, are guilty of. They are criminals, international criminals, and they have robbed us. They have stolen us. They have robbed us. They owe us, and we demand to be paid.
And you're referring to the United Nations Conference on Racism, correct, in Durban, in South Africa?
Yes, in 2000.
Is it true that the United States delegates to that conference walked out? Remind listeners a little bit about that event.
Well, the United States delegates walked out because they knew they were guilty and they knew that they would have to pay because the Durban conference was not going in their favor because they were there. They saw that it was not going in their favor and they could not stay because they would have to then face the music. So they left, but they left and we were still there and we got the reparations declaration. We got that the crime against humanity was committed and that the victims must be paid reparations and that the criminals must pay up.
Now, let me ask you this before you give me a little more details concerning the National Reparations Day itself. I want to ask you this question. Since the Durban Conference, things have changed dramatically on the ground, have they not? I mean, reparations has now become part of the so-called mainstream conversation, including on corporate media. What is your reaction to that?
My reaction to that is that if we continue to struggle, that we will win. When we went to Durban and we returned, the Twin Towers fell. That destroyed the momentum that we had built in Durban and had begun to organize here in the United States. That event destroyed the motion around reparation in terms of media and on ground work. But
I see, because it shifted all the conversation on issues of security. Yes. On all that stuff.
Yes, it shifted the conversation towards the lies of who is a terrorist and who is this a hero. But today, the shift has come back in our favor because we have been consistently waging war.
If you're persistent and you're engaged in the good fight based on the facts, the historical facts, that sooner or later you will be vindicated. Is that not the lesson here?
That is true. That is a historical reality. Look at the Chinese. Look at how many Mao started out with. Look at the Cubans. Look at how few Fidel and that party started out with. Look at Zimbabwe.
27.
Yes. Look at Zimbabwe. Look at South Africa. You understand? We study history and the struggle. We study that history, and we know that the struggle will be long and it will be hard, but we will win.
Listeners, if you're just tuning in and joining us, you're listening to Black Star News Show on WBAI New York 99.5 FM radio. I'm your host, Milton Alimadi, and our guest today in the second half hour is Brother Shahid Muhammad. He's one of the spokespersons and one of the organizers in December 12 movement of the National Reparations Day, which is August 15th. And there's going to be a rally, I believe it's at 2 p.m. at
yes,
the Trump International Hotel at Columbus Circle. Please That's continue. And my next question to you is this. Tell us a little bit about that day itself. What is December 12th movement wanting people to do on that day?
Okay, let me say this too, that Shahid may be talking now, but Shahid Muhammad and Loretta Vaughn have been assigned the task because we are members of an organization. And we are all given a task to do. And then we set about doing it. And the whole organization is at our disposal to carry out that assignment. So that's what's happening here. It is okay. Not Shahid, but it is the December 12th movement. And it is Loretta Vaughn and Shahid that's pushing this and pushing hard. Now, the day of August 15th, let's remember that we come from Durban in 2001, and our ancestor, Conrad Worrell, and the December 12th movement, at the conclusion of the Durban conference, they left Durban with the plan that they were going to conduct a reparations rally in the United States, and they selected August 17th. And you know what day that is, Milton Dick. That is the birth date of the most honorable Marcus yes. Mosiah Garvey.
Yes, of course.
And so we are holding fast and honoring Dr. Worrell and the warriors and all those who have gone on that have contributed to the fight for reparation that we have come to thus far. And that's what this day signifies. This day signifies reparations. This day signifies the fight for our liberation. This day signifies that we are going to demand and claim reparations. And we are calling all of our people from all the boroughs. And Milton, we are having organizations from around the country, Atlanta, Boston, California, Chicago, Columbia, Connecticut, Kansas City, Mississippi, Newark, Philadelphia, all are conducting Reparations Day campaigns one way or another, a webinar, they are getting in the streets, they are doing something. And see, it's a collective action because we are, with Milton, we are on the road to revolution. We want to be free.
And this collective effort beginning on that day, or rather picking up on what's already been going on all these years, what will it culminate in? Is there something that is planned in the future for Washington, D.C., for example?
Yes. See, this is one campaign on the road to freedom. This campaign will lead us to the next one. And the next one is going to be Black Solidarity Day. Black Solidarity Day will take us to another and another. The struggle continues. And we want everyone to come out to Columbus Circle in between Trump Towers and the statue of this racist pig Columbus right there at the mouth of Central Park. Christopher Columbus and Trump between two of the arch enemies of Black people's freedom.
And now that you mentioned Columbus, I expect, I know your response, but I want you to put it in your own words. The resistance by New York State Governor Cuomo to have the statue of Columbus removed from Columbus Circle. What is your reaction to that? In fact, as you may know, the mayor of New York City also has come out saying that he is not supporting the removal as well. He says he's going with the recommendation of a commission that he set up that found that the statue should not be removed. And the statue is now guarded 24/7 by about a dozen NYPD police officers, as if they had nothing better to do. What is your comment to that? And then I have about one or two more questions.
My comment to that is this. These white men are preserving the legacy of white supremacy and institutionalized racism. So it makes sense for white men to defend white institutions. That's why every African in the New York City area, in the sound of your program, should be out in the streets on August 15th at 2 p.m. defending the legacy of Black people to fight for reparations. See, white people fight for their beliefs. Black people should fight for their belief. And our belief is reparations is due us to repair the damage done to us by white supremacy. So that's not a surprise to me that they would come and defend the statue of this villainous person, Christopher Columbus.
Even in the post-George Floyd era, they're still doing this. Well, this is my last question to you then. Professor Darity of Duke University, who wrote this book that recently came out, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century, The Road to Equality. The book, by the way, is almost impossible to get a copy now. It keeps selling out. But in his book, he estimates that the total bill will be anywhere from $10 to $12 trillion. And he says it can be financed and funded. And he gave the example of the recent packages of financing out of Washington to try to deal with the economic disruption as a result of the coronavirus pandemic. He says, so they were able to do that. So he sees that this reparations project can also be funded and financed eventually. But here's the issue that he also raised. As you know, there's some efforts at the local level. So for example, Asheville, I believe, in North Carolina.
North Carolina.
They've come out with what they call is a reparations bill. And I guess it's good whenever funding, monies are going into African communities. People are getting money. But Professor Darity warns that this is dangerous. And in fact, he's against it. And this is why he says he's against it. He says because the total budget of all the local state governments and municipalities in the United States comes up to $3 trillion, right? He says there's no way can they fund national reparations. And the danger of calling this effort that is ongoing in Asheville, North Carolina, referring to it as reparations, is that the danger is that one day the federal government is going to come back and say, why are you still talking reparations when you already got it from places like Asheville and all the other local governments? So what is your view on that? I mean, should those programs continue, but perhaps maybe they should not call it reparations? What is your view on that?
Okay, let's deal with the first point, that this $10 trillion would bankrupt the country, and therefore it would be impossible. That would be a fool's errand to do such a thing.
Milton. No, he doesn't believe it can bankrupt the country if it's spread out over 10 years. He thinks it can't be financed. But go ahead, continue.
I have heard it said, look at the country of the United States of America alone. There is multiples of $10 trillion spent to construct and maintain this over the hundreds of years. My position, Milton, is that the United States owe us $777 trillion. And Milton, it is, should not be put into Chase, Wachovia, or any of those other banks controlled by white people.
Okay.
This is just monetary, Milton. They owe us monetary reparations as well as other forms of reparation.
Right, I understand. And in fact, you make a very good point, because some of the damage cannot even be monetized. So I'm glad you raised that point. But, you know, Brother Shahid, we are running out of time. I want you to maybe just say one more critical point that you cannot afford to leave out, and then tell people how to get in touch with December 12th to get more information. Those are the two things you should wrap up with.
They stole us, Milton. They stole us. They sold us. And they damn well owe us. What I'm saying is that August 15th,
yes,
at 2 p.m., all roads lead to 59th Street in Columbus Circle in front of the Trump International Hotel. Take the A train, as Duke Ellington told us. Take the A train to 59th Street and come upstairs. You'll be right there in the belly of the beast for that day. And we will raise the roof in holy hell for reparations now. Now, the other part of what you're saying, you can reach the December 12th movement by calling us at 718-398-1766. 718-398-1766, or go to d12m.com. d12m.com.
And that is all the time we have, Brother Shahid. Thank you for your time. We'll have you again in the future to discuss other resistance that you're involved in.
Thank you so much, Brother Milton.
Stay well, stay strong. Listeners, you also please remember to visit blackstarnews.com, and you can reach me at Ali Mahdi. Stay strong, stay Pan-African, and see you next week.
for WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York. I'm Amara Evering with some brief news headlines. Washington, D.C. reported 39 new coronavirus cases yesterday for a total of 12,313 confirmed cases. D.C. reported no new COVID-19-related deaths, keeping total fatalities to 586. The rate of community spread of the virus has begun to rise since mid-June, after a consistent decline since its peak in early May. In good news, D.C. has attempted a contact trace for 100% of new cases within one day of the case being reported, and managed to trace over 98% of close contacts of new cases within 2 days. But less than 5% of new cases were from quarantine contacts. This is well below the 60% level the district wants to remain above. Bed utilization at acute care hospitals has been stuck between 70 and 80% since late April, meaning local hospitals may not be equipped for a surge in COVID-19 hospitalizations. For more information on Phase 2 reopening and how to get tested, please visit coronavirus.dc.gov. In Virginia, Governor Northam has called for an eviction ban as evictions continue to rise in Virginia. He's asking that Virginia's high court delay hearings that could potentially leave thousands of residents homeless. In a letter he wrote to Chief Justice Donald Lemons, he states, quote, "There remains the distinct threat that the most vulnerable Virginians will be evicted from their homes at a time when our public health crisis is expanding rather than contracting." Negotiators are set to reconvene on Capitol Hill today to continue hammering out differences over a coronavirus relief package. There's still a wide gap between Republicans and Democrats on what should go into the stimulus bill. Republicans are refusing to support renewing a program to give unemployed workers an additional $600 in benefits. The enhanced benefits expired on Friday. The two parties are also at odds over aid to cities and states, funding for the U.S. Postal Service, and aid to renters facing eviction. Democratic leaders have warned that negotiations could continue through the middle of the month. Raul Grijalva, a Democratic Congress member in Arizona, has tested positive for coronavirus only 2 days after he chaired a meeting which was attended by Republican Congress member Louie Gohmert. At the meeting, Gohmert refused to wear a mask, though when he was tested later, it was revealed that he had coronavirus. Grijalva recently stated, quote, "This week has shown that there are members of Congress who fail to take this crisis seriously." Border Patrol officers in Arizona raided the medical camp of a humanitarian group on Friday. This camp provided food, water, and needed medical attention to refugees crossing into the U.S. by way of the desert. 30 people were detained as a result of this raid. It has been reported that this is the second raid to happen in only 2 days. Despite the widespread growth of the pandemic, the U.S. government continues to keep tens of thousands of asylum seekers and immigrants in detention centers. This ignores the advice of public health experts.